Welcome to The Young Turks. I'm Anna Kasparian. Francis Maxwell and Mark Thompson join us today. Obviously, Cenk is still away, but he will be back, I believe, tomorrow. So for those of you who missed Cenk, he will be back. But who cares? We have Francis Maxwell and Mark Thompson here. So that's even better. I'm just kidding. It's not even better. It's just as good. Maybe a little better. All right, guys. So we have a plethora of big stories for you. I don't want you to stop watching, so I'm gonna try not to share too much about how depressing these stories are, but there's a lot of news that we do have to get to. But before we do so, I want to give Francis a chance to give you guys a little info on something that he worked on that will be published on our channel tomorrow, correct?
Yes, I'm still being told I'm not allowed to say much, so it's hard because I wanna tell everyone. I mean, it's no secret, I was in Uganda. That alone was an amazing experience. I've never been to Africa. But it was for a very important project that's going to go live tomorrow. So there's going to be videos that are going to be going on the main show, I believe 8 a.m. Pacific time, and also on TYT Sports. So it's about a very important issue. I mean, if you just Google the June 20th, then you'll know what it's about. It's basically, it's a day that everyone knows of that's coming up, but I just can't give more details about the other parties involved, but it's worth a watch.
It's definitely cryptic. It's very mysterious. It makes me want to.
Yeah, the less you say, the more I want to watch.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, it's a Scotsman in Uganda, so I got red, very red. Saw a couple of elephants that were just like walking across the road.
Yeah.
It was, and I played some football, which they're football mad in Africa, so I loved that about it.
Nice.
It was a life changing event.
All right. Well, you guys ready for some news?
Yeah.
All right,
yeah.
Let's get to it. A 17-year-old Muslim girl has been reported as dead after she was assaulted by an individual who allegedly hit her with a metal bat. Now, this story is so devastating, and it seems as though it was possibly a random act of murder. However, police are not treating this as a hate crime, although individuals who know more about this story indicate that they do feel that the individual attacked the 17-year-old girl simply because she is a Muslim. Now, she and her friends were at a mosque, and since it's Ramadan, they were leaving the mosque together to go get a meal. Of course, during Ramadan, there's no consumption of food during the day, that all happens at night. And so they were planning on heading out to an IHOP to eat, and that was when this terrible person approached them and started the attack. Now, according to accounts from police and a mosque official, a group of four or five teens were walking back from breakfast at IHOP early Sunday when they were confronted by a motorist. All but one of the teens ran to the mosque where the group reported that the girl had been left behind. The girl is Nabra. Here's a photo of her, graphic one. And again, just an innocent 17-year-old girl. And to be quite honest with you, what I found interesting about the story is even though she was celebrating Ramadan, it was more of a social thing for her. She wasn't really all that religious, and she didn't wear a headdress often. She only did it because it was Ramadan. And many think that she was targeted, or the group of girls were targeted specifically because of the fact that they were wearing the headdress. Now, remains thought to be the girls were actually found at 3 p.m. Sunday in a pond. The girl's mother said detectives told her that Nabra was struck with a metal bat. Fairfax County Police identified the man charged with murder in her death as Darwin Martinez Torres of Sterling, Virginia. And here is his mugshot. Luckily, he is in custody. Police arrested him after they said that they saw him near the scene looking suspicious. But we don't have many details as to why they don't believe that it is a hate crime. We don't have details as to why they are tying him to this crime. All we know is that a 17-year-old girl, an innocent 17-year-old girl, lost her life for absolutely no reason at all. And it's an incredibly tragic story.
Yeah, it's a small community outside of Washington, D.C. And it's not one that is associated with this kind of violence, and certainly not with any kind of religious violence. And I know that they, as you say, they've exercised restraint as far as calling this a hate crime. But it's sort of very much, because it is Ramadan and because, as Anna says, she was dressed in traditional garb, it's tough not to at least have that in the back of your mind. In any case, this is, by all accounts, a fairly peaceful community. And even their family was sort of the source of so many congregants hanging out, having fun. I mean, it only makes it tragic that by all accounts she was really sort of a creature of real light and life. You know, it's a sad story.
I'm curious though to why they have came out and said that they're not investigating it as a hate crime without any further details that we know of yet. Because usually when you come out with something like that to the press, it seems like you've got other motive that you want to make sure is going to be held above that. I'm surprised that they've made that firm statement without even saying that it's possible that it could be investigated as a hate crime, because from what the testimony from the friends, the testimony from the girl's father, who, by the way, I want to go on a little quick side note. I read a piece on him recently that broke my heart outside, where he said that he's going to go to the courtroom, he's going to look at this evil individual and say, why did you do this to my daughter? And then he's going to forgive him and leave it up to God to judge him. And that's the, you know, that's the Muslim community that's just, they're not a religion of peace, right? They don't care about anyone else, they just care about their own. No, that's how a father in this instance is trying to grieve over this situation. It's a horrific, horrific case. But the testimonies from the friends and from what he's stating would at least lead them to believe that that needs to be investigated.
Right.
So I'm surprised why it's been ruled out almost.
So again, this story just broke and we don't have all the details. The police are not being transparent, probably because they are in the middle of investigating it. Obviously, they have some information that we don't have. So I'm unsure as to why they're not treating it as a hate crime. And you know, the only thing that I do want to stay away from is speculating as to what's really going on. Because I don't think that that's a responsible way to cover the story. However, you know, the parents are convinced that this was a hate crime. In fact, according to the Washington Post, in conversations with detectives, the victim's mother said she was told the driver shouted at the teens, then threw glass beer bottles at them. Here's a quote from the mother. She says, "I'm sure the guy hit my daughter because she's Muslim and she was wearing the hijab. The only thing in my head is, why did he do that to us? We're not bad people. He doesn't know us. Why did he ever do that? I don't feel safe at all anymore as a Muslim living here now." And I think, you know, considering what recently happened in Oregon on, you know, public transportation and some of the more extreme opinions that we're hearing, or the extreme rhetoric that we're hearing about certain groups of people, particularly Muslims, you know, you have to keep in mind that rhetoric does matter, and rhetoric matters from both the right and the left. And we just, we're all getting caught up in the polarization, the fear mongering, the hate. And if you are a mentally stable person, you're unlikely to be influenced by that rhetoric to the point where it incites violence, to the point where you go out there and you do something violent. But keep in mind that not everyone is mentally stable, right? And so what you say matters, and we need to tone it down. We need to be careful. That's all I'm saying.
So true that the rhetoric is incendiary. But the other point, I really like that you made a reference to that. The fact is, the nature of this community isn't one of radicalism necessarily. I mean, this, the TYT audience knows, but it's in the shadow of that van tragedy in London. You'll remember the imam, you maybe even heard about it in the first hour if you're with us, comes out and actually pulls the crowd off of the van driver. This is the guy who just drove into this crowd of Muslim worshipers. Mm-hmm. They're sitting there wailing on him, they're angry. He's just perpetrated this horrible thing. And the imam comes out and pulls them off of him because, again, he doesn't want that to be to have any component in the day's events. And so it's really to your point. It's just it's a community that is not defined by this radicalism. And then there are more and more examples, unfortunately, in the shadows of these tragedies.
And I wanted to go back to what Anna said. I think that's very important that we have to wait. We have to be bigger than rather than jump into conclusions. I think the 30 to 35 minutes after any sort of attack happens on the internet is some of the worst that you'll see, because everyone just wants to use it as political mudslinging. But on the other side of it as well, we need to start being more transparent with what we are describing as terrorism. You just mentioned the attack yesterday. I was disgusted last night as I was on, after it had been announced that it was a terrorist attack deliberately towards Muslims outside the mosque. The Daily Mail ran a brief headline, right? I think they corrected themselves later, but the brief headline says, "Clean-shaven white man held was held afterwards." Now that was after it'd already been described as it was an attack on Muslims. So why all of a sudden was the man's appearance and his clean-shaven appearance one of the reasons why he was describing it? And it took me back to a New York Post article that I ripped apart not long ago for describing the dapper individual who was in New York who committed the attack on Timothy Coleman.
It's just a double standard in the way that headlines are written about specific groups of people, right?
Yeah,
so if you don't fit what society has deemed the perfect model of a terrorist, which is a Muslim with dark features, well, then you're not really a terrorist. You might be a bad guy, but are you clean shaven though?
And are you
dapper though?
It happens.
Because that matters. That matters.
Of course it does. And there was there's articles that I actually enjoy reading. There was one that I just called out recently on New York Daily News 5 minutes ago before I came in here. They said the Welshman who committed the attack in London, the father of four, stop humanizing him. He's a terrorist. That's what he is. Call him a terrorist first, and you want to go into the details later, because most people won't even read that. They'll just read it and they'll suddenly have this conception that, oh, well, I guess he's not a terrorist then, because he's a father of four and he committed this attack.
It humanizes them, right? It's and it makes insane. Them relatable. And so you can't, look, if you are in the business of doing fair journalism, then you can't have that double standard. Mm. Doesn't matter if you're Muslim, doesn't matter if you're white. If you terrorize people, you're a terrorist. If you're running your van into a group of innocent individuals, you are a terrorist.
Absolutely.
So that's what we're dealing with right now, and we will give you updates on this story as it develops. All right, moving on to other news. A black woman who called the authorities in Seattle to report a burglary was unfortunately victimized by the cops after she was shot by the two responding Seattle police officers. Now, the cops alleged that the woman was holding a knife at the time that they arrived at the scene, and she did have a history of mental illness and a history with the police. So let's give you the full story. Both Seattle Police Department officers opened fire on Charlena Lyles inside the apartment building after they said she confronted them brandishing a knife. She died at the scene. There were actually several children inside the apartment during Sunday's incident, though they were uninjured. They did witness their mother getting shot and killed, though. The incident comes 4 days after Lyles was released from King County Jail following her arrest on June 5th for threatening police officers with large kitchen scissors inside her small and cluttered apartment. So her family says that she had a mental illness that unfortunately was getting worse. And when she had the previous episode with the cops, she was alleging or yelling at them and saying that they were the KKK and they were out to get her. So clearly this woman was not mentally sound and needed help and needed to be treated differently from other people. But nonetheless, she was the one who called the cops to report a suspected burglary. And unfortunately, she was the one that was killed as a result of that. The Seattle Police Department has been implementing court-ordered reform since 2012 to address what the US Justice Department investigation found to be a pattern of excessive force by officers that often arose during encounters with the mentally ill or drug-addled suspects. Also keep in mind that same Justice Department investigation found that the police department in Seattle had a racial bias that played a role in the way that they carried out their policing.
This is another tough, very tough story. Specifically in this day and age, where of course, when it comes to another black American citizen dying at the hands of police, you immediately react, or you don't react, but you start to think about all the scenarios that you've played out. I mean, we just had Philando Castile, the murder of Philando Castile be ruled as just another normalized police encounter last week. And move forward, Terrence Crutcher, everything else, it continuously plays a role in how you perceive these events. Now, this event is a little bit different, of course, because this woman in the situation had a weapon, and there was a history of her being not mentally stable, as you mentioned. The officers, in responding to this, were aware of that situation because they were told of the address. They know that this woman was mentally unstable and have had some instances in the past with her. So therefore, you would think that they would be understanding on how to approach this. But again, it takes me back to my bias coming from a country where we don't have guns. So there's plenty of other ways you can deal with a situation.
Right.
A lot of criminal activity in the United Kingdom, where I'm from, is a lot of people having knives. And officers have to try to find a situation in order to de-escalate it. There was a brilliant video that was out last year where it showed officers from the United States were sitting in with Scottish police officers as they were watching a scenario where a man was running with a knife. And I think it was like 10 seconds before one of the officers said, yeah, he'd be dead. He'd be shot. Because it's the go-to. It's the way that it's often you see something that is going to cause a problem. The only way to deal with it is with a gun.
So let me jump in really quickly. Because I just want to make a point about something that I think needs to be clarified before we move forward. First of all, I don't think anyone on this panel is saying, I don't think you're saying that, oh, she's just holding a knife, it's no big deal.
No, absolutely not.
No, if someone's brandishing a knife, obviously there is a threat there. There's no question about it. However, to meet that threat with a lethal weapon, I think is disproportionate, right? I think that that is a level of force that's unnecessary. I don't know what happened to the times when cops use non-lethal weapons in order to subdue individuals, especially individuals that pose a threat like this situation. And to be completely fair, this story is also a breaking news story. We don't know all the details, so we don't know exactly how she was acting. But far too often we come across stories where either someone is completely unarmed and then they're met with deadly force, or in this case, they're armed with something like a knife and they could be met with, let's say, a taser if they genuinely pose a threat. Yeah. Oh, I mean, you're talking about a thin woman and two male police officers that I'm sure could have handled it differently, right?
Yeah, it's interesting. We call on cops to do a lot in this society. You know, they're not just called like Batman and Superman are when moments have reached sort of a critical time. In this case, they're called. We know this person's mentally unstable. When they get there, as Anna says, she has a knife. A knife is a legitimate weapon that threatens those peace officers on some level. But also to Anna's point, and this gets back to what I was saying about we call on the cops to do a lot. They have to find a different way to de-escalate the situation. And as Francis said, they actually go through exercises that are associated with de-escalating these situations.
It goes back to training.
So it does go back to training. But we'll say this, you cops out there, we know you have a tough gig. I mean, it's very, very hard. But having said that, some situations, it would seem, might be easier to decode than others. And at least looking at the specifics of this situation with the knife, as Anna said, there have to be less lethal means of getting toward a resolution. And they're
training,
being.
When I say training, it's not just about, find a way to de-escalate a situation with the average person that you run into who might pose a threat. There also needs to be an emphasis on training regarding those who have mental disabilities, right? Because that is not something that's emphasized. A lot of cops are met with situations where someone might have, let's say, paranoid schizophrenia, right? And so someone might be acting in a certain way that might be deemed a threat, but they're not, completely cognizant of what's going on. And there has to be proper training in order for them to deal with that situation. And again, yes, the caveat is mentioned over and over again, should be mentioned over and over again. They do have hard jobs.
No doubt. They do
put their lives on the line and they do put their lives at risk. But at the same time, situations like this, in my opinion, can be de-escalated and you can actually, avoid murdering someone in order to carry out your job in a logical, rational way.
The reason why I brought up the stuff beforehand is not that I was trying to downplay that there was danger. Of course there's danger. What I'm trying to do is that this situation should be an example where you can look to in the past to see, okay, how are we going to try to de-escalate this situation so others can look to it and take reference from it so that when a Philando Castile is reaching for his papers in his car, you don't feel like your life is threatened because maybe you can take refuge in the fact that someone else had dealt with a situation where someone had a weapon like a knife and you were able to try and overcome the situation without killing another person. That is what I'm trying to stress is like, you're not going to learn by just simply looking at the best case scenarios of being, okay, they didn't have a weapon, we were able to do it without a gun. And then as soon as there's any sort of weapons, the only way to deal with it is death.
Right.
You can't work on those two ends of the spectrum. You have to be able to look at it and see, okay, so someone does have a weapon, what is the stages I can go to? And I'm talking about this sitting behind a desk. I'm not a fool to think that it's not hard when you're out there on the streets and you're running into people that, yes, with this very high tense climate we have right now with policing and black citizens in the country, that there's going to be tensions, there's going to be fear. But the reason police officers do this job is because they're supposed to go through the training and they're supposed to be able to handle it better than an everyday citizen. That's why they go through this training. That's why when a situation like a Terence Crutcher, when he's walking away, you shouldn't feel any inclination to fire your weapon as the first response when someone's walking away, or the next response.
Or Scott Walker running away. Literally running away, does not pose an imminent threat, but he still gets shot in the back several times. I don't know how many of these stories need to occur for people to actually understand. There isn't an anti-cop agenda, okay? Cops are necessary. Cops are an important part of society. But you know what else is important? Maintaining people's lives, saving people's lives. That's the whole point of being a cop, to protect and serve. And you know, I think the vast majority of cops are good people, and I think they do their jobs responsibly. But far too often we come across cases like this where someone's life didn't need to end. There could have been a different response or a different reaction to it. And unfortunately, it ended with a woman with a mental illness being shot and killed.
And the last thing, just to throw it in at the end, after this stuff happens, it seems in the aftermath as though the investigations really leave you cold. I mean, it's just, there's not enough of a consequence to so many of these horrible stories that Anna mentions day after day on this show and that we read about and hear about. I mean, it's become business as usual in America that the investigation just finds that the officers aren't really culpable in any sort of way that sticks. It's really an outlier, though, when you find a situation where there has to be a price paid for the kind of default to violence that we see in these stories.
Well, what you're going to see with this, the last point on this is that's very true, because what they're going to do is they'll draw an underline under this and they'll say, okay, she had a weapon, done.
That's right.
So there's no reason to, and that's where it starts to become cloudy, so that when you have, again, what we stated, these cases that continuously get dismissed, is because they're in a way, they're trying to contemplate how they can make an excuse for officers, because they're trying to find weapons, they're trying to find drugs, they're trying to find these things so that they can make
just an excuse. Just like with Philando Castile, right?
Other than punishing those that go to that extreme means before going through any other stages in between.
Right. All right, guys, we got to take a break. When we come back, an update on the Bill Cosby story, his trial, how did it end, and will there be any updates? And then later on, we will talk about sex offenders and whether or not the Supreme Court believes they should be allowed to use social media. Come right back. Welcome back to TYT. I just want to mention that the woman that we talked about in the last story, who was shot and killed by Seattle police officers, was pregnant. I missed that fact. I knew, but unfortunately, I forgot to mention that as we were reporting the story. It's just as
it's made it even more tragic.
It
wasn't tragic enough.
Yeah, no. It just gets worse. So I wanted to make sure that the audience was aware of that. I apologize for missing that in the original reporting of that story. Let's do some TYT live tweets. Edward says, a mental health episode in America equals a dead person because cops are not trained to deal with it. That's true. And also, you know, there was a federal court that ruled in regard to whether or not it's considered reasonable suspicion if an individual is simply running away from cops once they arrive on a scene. And the court had ruled that it is not, because certain groups of people simply don't trust cops, right? And so some people might think, well, why don't you trust cops? Like, I've had great experiences with cops, so they've always helped me. Why would you be afraid of them? Why wouldn't you trust them? Look, if you are part of a community that deals with, you know, people in your family getting murdered after they call the cops for help, you know, you're not gonna trust them. You're not gonna trust them. And that story to me shows why so many individuals do their own policing in their own communities, which, you know, sometimes is not the best situation or the best solution. And I'm talking about people who do vigilante justice instead of referring to cops for help. But anyway, I can't deal with that story anymore. We have to move on. All right, a typical Southerner says cops need to be trained to talk people down in violent situations, just like they would with potential bridge jumpers. That's actually a really great point. De-escalation. I don't know how much emphasis there is on that when it comes to police training, but it doesn't seem like much. And by the way, I mean, obviously, departments throughout the country have their own standards and their own training, and so there's no uniform training within the country. Everyone just kind of has their own way of doing things, which is why some departments seem to have more of an issue than others. All right, and then finally, I want to do some member shout outs. Jason Grant and Tyler Booth, thank you so much for being members. You guys help keep our show running. You help keep us independent. If you want to be a member, just go to tytnetwork.com/join. Today, we're going to have an awesome post-game show, hopefully about something that's not insanely depressing.
Please.
I know. It's just, as I was putting the rundown together today, I always try to include at least one story that's not sad, right?
But is it not hard to like switch as well when you go through the rundown and then you have one kind of uplifting at the end, because it just takes you?
Well, yeah, sometimes it is. But you know, it's funny because I remember a few years ago, it wasn't hard to include some of the more light stories. Mm-hmm. And now it's like, the transition's impossible. How do you go from a 17-year-old Muslim getting murdered, a black woman with a mental illness getting shot and killed by cops as she calls for help with a burglary situation? Like, how do you go from those stories to, I don't know, the fun stuff?
It's always interesting to think. I was having this conversation with don't want to digress too long, but with my brother of all people, said, "Hey, I just don't want to bring a child. I'm not going to have kids. I don't want to bring a child into this world. It's too dark a place." And I said, "But if you really look at the world through time, when could you really periscope up and go, you know what? Now's the time
to bring it in.
In other words, there's always been this darkness in the world. I will give you the fact that this feels particularly dark.
Yeah.
But I think there's never a moment where you look around and you go, hey, you know what, things are really cool. You know, you could say, well, after World War II, really? After World War II, blacks and whites couldn't drink out of the same fountain here in this country?
If you wanted Twitter after World War II, then you would know the full wrath of the darkness after that. Because that's what it is. It's the way you can absorb it. It's not just a story that is dark. Next minute, it's the guy who's telling you about the story and why they deserve to die and why they deserve this. It just enhances the darkness.
Anyway, we'll get into lighter stuff for the post-game.
Yes, well, you guys start thinking about topics, we'll do something fun. All right. Bill Cosby's criminal trial in regard to his alleged sexual assault against a woman named Andrea Constand has ended in a mistrial. Prosecutors plan on filing another trial against him. However, the jury in this case was, quote, hopelessly deadlocked, meaning that they could not come up or agree to a verdict. Now, to give you some backstory on Bill Cosby and Constand, he was accused of sexually assaulting her back in 2004. She did file a civil lawsuit against him in 2005, and they did settle out of court for an unspecified amount of money. Now, in 2015, after dozens of women came forward and alleged that he had drugged them and sexually assaulted them, a judge had agreed to make a deposition that he had recorded in that 2005 case public. And in that deposition, he admitted to using drugs to, you know, drug women that he was interested in having sexual relations with. And in the Constand story, he claimed that he had given her Benadryl to relax her. And in this case, it was interesting because the prosecution brought forth experts who indicated that Benadryl has been used in the past by individuals who want to subdue victims in order to take advantage of them. But it didn't matter because it did end in a mistrial. The jury could not agree. Now, according to the Washington Post, the jury said it was hopelessly deadlocked on Saturday, was selected in Pittsburgh, then bused to suburban Philadelphia and sequestered during 11 days of testimony and deliberations. Now, it's likely that Cosby's defense team will try to block a new trial, but legal experts say they are unlikely to prevail. The retrial is expected to bear many similarities to the first trial, but there might be key differences that could affect the outcome. Now, one of the key differences to keep in mind is the prosecution now knows the strategy of the defense. So, with a retrial, they would be better prepared to kind of counterbalance or at least mitigate any type of argument that the defense can make. And so we'll see how that all plays out. Kevin Steele, who is the career prosecutor in this case, will have insights in the trial or the retrial that he did not have in the first trial. He and his key witnesses have now gotten a detailed view of the defense team strategy and its methods of handling cross-examination.
I hope Bill Cosby brings back that fake blind guy thing for the second trial. That is a great, great move. And I never get tired of it. The old infirm blind man who's used to be America's favorite Dr. Huxtable being dragged into court by some woman who's just made this stuff up. By the way, as Anna says, there was a big check written to her already. She has no economic interest in going through this.
Right.
Her only interest is justice. So looking forward to seeing Bill and that same tired walk that he does where he pretends he can't see anything. He's going out as one of the great BS artists of primetime television history.
Well, what's incredible is it's not just Constand that has nothing to gain from this situation, right? There were multiple women, dozens of women who came forward where the statute of limitations has already passed the statute of limitations, mm-hmm. indicating that, you know, they're not necessarily going to get any type of justice, but they came forward to share their stories because they felt like it was important to tell the truth about what happened to them and kind of raise awareness about what occurred. Also, keep in mind that that's not an easy thing to do, right?
Absolutely not.
I mean, they've been demonized, they've been antagonized. Any sexual assault victim, male or female, just gets dragged through the mud when they come forward, which is why so many victims never come forward.
Yeah, this may have had a chilling effect in just that way, in any kind of future complaints. It really makes you realize what we put the victims of sexual assault through the justice system, a place you go for justice. And by the time you get to the end of it, you feel maligned yourself.
Yeah, and that was kind of the point I was going to stress on it as well, is that it's not just the specific case here for Constance. This is almost for anyone out there who has potentially been sexually assaulted and is scared of speaking out, but specifically when someone is in a position of power. I think I should just have a button where I repeat this every time we do a specific case on sexual assault. One of the most underreported and one of the most underprosecuted crimes in the United States, especially when the perpetrator is known or is someone in a position of power or is a celebrity figure. Mm-hmm. I mean, the way that, specifically when it comes to women, this is why I talk about this as an example, the way that women are treated. Now, I get it. In this system today, innocent till proven guilty. But that doesn't mean that it's just they're constantly attacked by character after character, like all
character
the things
assassination
to make sure that it's almost it's almost just thrown out the window before you can even hear their case. And it's no surprise why so many people don't want to come forward, because they feel like they're just going to be either laughed off or they're going to be gold diggers that are looking to get money. This woman in this instance has already been paid in the past, but she wants justice because she doesn't want this to happen again down the line. She doesn't want a case like this to be passed off, whether it's the statute of limitations, whether the guy's a celebrity figure, whether he's already got a reputation that he would never do that.
And also, I think at this point, I mean, there are prosecutors involved that want to press charges. It doesn't even really necessarily matter what she wants. Yeah. They see that that there was potentially criminal activity or criminal behavior here, and the prosecutors want to do something about it. They want justice, which, you know, I know that in the past, you know, we've done a lot of stories of prosecutors maybe doing things unethically or doing things for the wrong intentions. But at least in this case, it seems as though the prosecutor, Kevin Steele, does want to do the right thing. And look, it was a mistrial. It's not like he was found to be innocent and it's a double jeopardy or whatever. That's what it's called, right? Double jeopardy?
Right, double jeopardy. Yeah. If you were found innocent and then retried.
Right.
And you're right to point that out, and you're making me remember that after the mistrial, as Anna says, that's not a victory. You know, there's no not guilty verdict coming in.
Right.
And yet, they're proclaiming this victory. The fact that it was a mistrial clearly indicates that my client has been wrongly accused. And, you know, now, as you see, we get into the court of public opinion, they're trying to create their own case.
Right.
This guy has got blood all over him. And he's a disgusting, despicable man. And it's a sad comment, I think, that this jury was hung. And if you look at the demographics, you look at black and white and rich and poor, and you look at this jury, you begin to maybe start to decode how this happened. I mean, I think it's these people who want to retain their vision of sweet Dr. Huxtable. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's insanity, but those are the people who don't want to let go of a not guilty verdict.
Yeah. All right, moving on to some other news. The Supreme Court made an interesting ruling in regard to sex offenders in North Carolina. Now, North Carolina is a state that has a certain law on the books pertaining to the social media use of registered sex offenders. In fact, if you are a registered sex offender, if you have done certain things that have made you a registered sex offender, you are not allowed to use social media. And of course, the thought process behind that is that you could potentially use social media to prey on underage children. Now, in this case, though, the Supreme Court actually did strike down North Carolina's law Monday that bars convicted sex offenders from Facebook, Twitter, and also other social media sites. The justices even ruled unanimously in favor of North Carolina's resident, Lester Packingham Jr. That is the person who has been registered as a sex offender. He was 21 years old when he had sexual relations with a 13-year-old, which is why he was convicted and had to register. Now, interestingly enough, he had used a family member's Facebook page to brag about the fact that he was let go from a traffic citation. And there were cops investigating social media to see if there were any registered sex offenders using it when they weren't supposed to, and they came across his post. And so as a result, that was considered violating his probation. And then this whole case went all the way up to the Supreme Court, and now we have this ruling. So I'm really curious to hear what you guys think. Do you think registered sex offenders should be allowed to use social media? And just to be clear, it doesn't really matter what we think. We're not the Supreme Court. Mm-hmm. But I am curious to hear what public opinion is all about.
The sex offender title is an interesting one. And there's a proposal here in California to actually rank, as they do in other states, in many states, the degree of sexual offense, because there's obviously a wide breadth of sexual offenders. I mean, pathetic as it is, there is. So there has to be a level, a threshold of sexual offense, it would seem to me, that does bar you from using social media, since it's the means by which, as you've said, Anna, people reach out. These people reach out to underage girls, typically, but it can be both sexes.
Yep.
I'm troubled by this, because on the one hand, I think you should have access to all of the, social media is information and it's a lot of other things. On the other hand, I think at some level there should be a threshold of sexual offense that where you're DQ'd, you're disqualified from use of these media.
Well, okay, so let me give you the argument by the Supreme Court, which again ruled unanimously in favor of allowing registered sex offenders to use social media. In sum, to foreclose access to social media altogether is to prevent user from engaging in the legitimate exercise of First Amendment rights. That was the opinion written by Justice Kennedy. And I think that that is a good point. And I have a lot of problems with the way with sex offenders and the way that they're treated by our justice system. And let me finish my thought before you guys freak out, because look, I think that to prey on underage kids is disgusting. No one's in favor of it, and they should be punished. However, there are states that consider people who urinate in public sex offenders. So there's a very weird, broad definition of what sex offender means.
That's
in
what
some
I was
states.
Saying, yeah.
Yeah, and so, so what do we do? Do we demonize these people for the rest of their lives, have them register as sex offenders, bar them from using social media? That absolutely does violate their First Amendment rights. Look, they are already barred from meeting with or being anywhere near minors.
Okay? Right. Yeah.
So if they do that, if they take that extra step of meeting with minors when they're not supposed to, they're in trouble. But if they're simply on social media, I don't see that as necessary. Like I don't see that we need to stop them from using the internet and completely like shun them from our normal day-to-day activities.
Yeah, I'm a little torn as well, because of course with how many kids are so active on social media today, it's a playground that sexual predators can, if that is what we're looking at in this example with the worst case, they can look to prey on young kids online, like sexual predators have been doing for many years. If they're barred from a playground or barred from a school, then they shouldn't be allowed on an area where they can prey on them. But at the same time, I'm torn, because if a sexual predator wants to go and prey on kids and they're banned from doing it on social media, if perhaps there's a past instance, could you not track them? And therefore, you could try to find preventative ways to stop them if they've gone and repeat.
So if they are banned from social media, will they find, and they want to do it, that's not going to stop them. They're probably going to try and find other means to do it. And then that's maybe I mean that you can't track. Maybe they're going and doing it in person. Unless you want to follow them around every day, which I'd be all for if there was enough police officers out there. But I'm saying that it is such a complex issue, because I'm trying to think, what's the way that you can prevent something so horrendous from happening again? And as you mentioned, there is people out there that are classified as sex offenders for just needing to go pee sometimes. And they're doing it in an area that's classified as that. So they're maybe going to have to face the harsh punishment of not being allowed to be on social media at any point. Yeah. But
I think it's a case by case basis. If there's someone who happens to be a pedophile, registered sex offender, who is caught utilizing social media to further victimize or prey on kids, then obviously just use human judgment. That person should not be allowed to use social media. He's using it as a tool to carry out a crime. But in this case, there was no evidence of that. He simply used social media to brag about how he beat a traffic ticket. And so, look, with every other crime,
if he used social media to brag about the fact that he was peeing on the side of a building,
then he might just barely reach
the threshold.
Right.
Yeah. But there has to be a threshold. Yeah. I think we all agree on that.
Yes.
That there are gradations of this of sexual offenders. And once you reach a certain threshold, then certain restrictions would be wise to be imposed.
Yes.
But if you haven't reached that threshold, and it's an example of the guy pissing on the side of a building, I mean, that's just not a guy who you want to apply the same restrictions to as you do somebody who's legitimately, involved in something with a child.
Real quick, 2 weeks ago, I went camping with my husband, and we're camping and it's kind of hard to come across a bathroom. And it was really funny because there was a park ranger. Okay, he needed to go, so he's doing his business. And as he's doing his business, a park ranger, a female park ranger, starts walking by. And my heart sank. I'm like, stop. I'm like screaming, stop. And he doesn't understand what's going on. And I'm freaking out. And finally, he didn't realize in time what was going on.
It's hard to stop, by the way, in the middle, isn't it?
Very hard to stop. Extreme.
Sorry, Anna, go ahead. Yeah.
But she walked by, and then she realized what was happening. And then she was like, oh my God, no, don't worry about it, don't worry. And she just walked the other way. And I was like, oh, thank God. But I mean, I don't even know what would have happened in that situation. I don't know what California's laws are about public urination, but I've heard too many horror stories.
Well, you're camping in the woods?
Well, we were camping, but we were near the entrance of this national park. And so an argument could have been made by anyone who really wanted to go after us that it was considered public urination. I don't know. But I didn't want to take any risk.
Yeah.
So I was so scared.
Poor guy, midstream, just
scared. I know, I know.
Another lawless urinator, everybody. And who would have thought
it was a bear or something.
Comes out of Anna's family. Well.
Oh my God, I'd die if anything happened to him. It would be the worst thing in the world. He's the nicest guy. Can you imagine? Oh
honey,
my
nicest guy. I told you to hold it in.
All right. I'm actually going to skip ahead to the last story just because I find it so fascinating. I want to make sure we cover it. All right. A new study published in the New England Journal of Medicine finds that obesity is not an epidemic that has subsided. In fact, it has gotten worse, and the trends are really alarming. What the researchers found in this case is that more than 10% of the world's population, that's 107.7 million children and 603.7 million adults, is now obese. Okay, so I want to show you a fun little chart that was created by Vox to show you, what the trend kind of looks like. And if you look, since the 1980s, there has been an upward trend for every demographic, men, women, and children. So since 1980, the obesity prevalence has doubled in more than 70 countries around the world, mainly in low and middle income regions, and it has steadily increased in nearly every other country. Now, this is the part of the study that I really want to stress, because while some of you might already know this, while some of you have probably been screaming this from mountaintops and trying to get people to understand, a lot of people are under the impression that As long as you're physically active, you can eat whatever you want and you'll have a healthy body weight. But that is not the case. And finally, this study clearly lays that out. Physical activity levels began to decline before the global obesity rate started to surge, which means changes to the food environment are the prime obesity culprit. So the researchers here are saying, no, it is not a lack of exercise. This has everything to do with the types of foods we're eating, the amount of food we're eating. And so they focus on that more than, you know, physical activity. Exercise is excellent for health. That's not to say you shouldn't exercise, but it's not important for weight loss. The two things should never be given equal weight in the obesity debate. Now, a few more details for you guys before you jump in. The researchers estimated that a high body weight contributed to 4 million deaths globally, or 7% of the deaths from any cause in 2015. Most of those deaths were caused by cardiovascular disease, with diabetes following closely behind, along with kidney disease, which, by the way, is exacerbated or even triggered by diabetes, and also cancers. So this is just incredible, especially when you consider the number of people, the fact that it impacts not only the United States or other developed countries, but it impacts a lot of different countries. In fact, they looked at nearly 200 different countries and found that this trend is true of pretty much everywhere that they went, except for Vietnam, by the way.
These are countries that didn't have this problem for a long time, obviously.
Right.
And we, I hate to be a self-hating Westerner, but we have exported this cheap, crappy food to the world. And I'm not saying, I know that many of us like the dip to McDonald's or whatever as an indulgence. I don't need it, but I understand it. But what's happening is that's a low cost way to get this calorie intense food, but it's nutrient poor, and it's going to all of these different countries all over the world. And as we've exported this, we've also exported our obesity problem. Mm-hmm. So I think it starts, we're the prime movers in this.
No doubt. I think it's several things that contributed to it. And I think that lack of education is a huge one. That's what, whenever I talk about specific issues in health, I always stress that the simple things, like people will consider pizza, I believe, to be a vegetable, and it's in the United States because it's got tomato puree in it. Like, just absurd things like
that. Politicians will argue. They will literally argue that the tomato sauce or the ketchup in the school lunches is
disgusting,
considered a vegetable because they don't want to spend the extra money to provide decent school lunches for students. Sorry to interrupt.
No, that's a point that I wasn't aware of until I came to this great country, and I was, what are you saying? Like, pizza? It baffles me, but at the same point, you need to understand that everything that you put into your body is going to have to be adjusted in a way that if you work out, and you're just eating, you're not going to see any sort of change in your body. Not to look on the furthest end of the spectrum if you're trying to lose weight. I'm talking about if you just want to make a slight change in your body, I could go to the gym for months. But if I go and eat crap every single day, nothing, I'm going to get worse. Nothing's going to change. I don't care if I'm running 5-6 miles a day, because it's all about understanding what your body needs in order to get healthier, in order to adjust. And that starts with education.
Yes.
From a very early age, telling kids that, yeah, you're eating an odd McDonald's once in a while is not going to kill you, but you have to be having cooked meals that are making sure that that is not a means to go and get fast food to try and avoid going and getting some groceries and cooking your own food. And it's about understanding that the quicker option is not the easy alternative, which people try to say, go to McDonald's, it's really quick, just go there, it's only a dollar. That's not an easy alternative.
I have so much to say about this, and I do want to continue this conversation during our post-game show. So if you are a member, you can check that out. If you're not, you can go to tytnetwork.com/join to become a member. But one thing that I do want to emphasize is, yes, education is part of it, but I do believe that another part of it, and I consider myself pretty educated when it comes to health, right, and what to do to keep myself healthy. Dude, sometimes though, I mean, you're so overworked and you're so stressed out. And the idea of me going to a grocery store after work and dealing with people, okay?
Yeah, but there are
like, it's inconceivable to me. So sometimes I want that quarter pounder of cheese, and quarter pounder of cheese. So I think a lot of people also relate to that. And let's elaborate
we'll
on this a little
that,
more
yeah.
in our post game. Francis Maxwell, Mark Thompson, thank you so much for joining us.
Appreciate it.
Thank you for watching, guys. I really appreciate it. Cenk will be back tomorrow. And for everyone else, please check out the post game show, tytnetwork.com/join. Love you. We'll see you tomorrow.